things you call it, you forget Torah. Now, because I'll say certain types of food, certain types of activities, they cause you to forget Torah. That doesn't mean it's a guarantee. It doesn't mean you forget 100%. But it affects your memory. And Rav Chaim Kineski wrote a whole sefer analyzing the different chazals about kasha l'shichecha. For example, it emphasizes eating unbaked dough. So if you like cookies and cream ice cream, there might be a problem with that. Eating lev, eating a heart, so which is interesting. There's a whole shayla about what about a hot dog? A hot dog has, among other things in it, that type of thing. But he makes the point that there's an issur d'oraisa to deliberately cause yourself to forget Torah. And therefore, this kasha l'shichecha would involve, I want you to be very strict about those things. But to explain why something, why a given thing is kasha l'shichecha, that's really Kabbalah. I mean, it's hard for us to understand that. They're not rational things. They're really spiritual, supernatural things.
What does kasha mean?
Why the word kasha?
Yeah.
Well, kasha, you think because literally would mean difficult for forgetful. You might think that means you'll remember it well. No, kasha, I think, is understood to be something that's, it is difficult to you. It is bad for you, kasha for you, because of shech. Kasha, because of shech. So that would be the lesson. But it's a negative thing. It's not a positive thing.
And one more thing is wearing two different socks. Is that kasha l'shichecha?
No, I'm not aware of that. Chazal talk about wearing a garment in reverse is kasha l'shichecha. I'm not familiar with two different socks being kasha
l'shichecha. How do we differentiate between the Kabbalistic notion of distinct, separate emanations of Hashem and Trinitarianism?
Well, that was a very good very good question, and indeed that is some of the people that were against the popularization of Kabbalistic teachings was that they said that it could be very easily misinterpreted in terms of duality, multiplicity, different aspects of God, similar lahavdil, of course, to the Trinity or other things. The best I can tell you is a mashal that Rav Moshe Cordovero gives. Rav Moshe Cordovero, called the Ramak, was second only to the Arizal. He was the main Makubal in Tzfat when the Arizal came. Rav Moshe Cordovero died shortly thereafter. And Rav Moshe Cordovero had a different mahalach than the Ari. Rav Moshe Cordovero was he was called the Morin of Uchim. He was called the Rambam of Kabbalah because he tried to explain Kabbalistic ideas in philosophical terms. The Ari was more of a mystical side of Kabbalah. But the mashal that Rav Moshe Cordovero gives is, imagine if you have clear water and you pour the water into different colored glasses. So when it's in the red glass, the water looks red. When it's in the blue glass, it looks blue. But the essence of the water is unchanged. It is simply how I perceive it as it goes through the different glasses. So he says the idea of spheros, there's chesed, loving kindness, and gevura, are simply veils or containers that mask or color a unique, the distinct essence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is the same under all and all circumstances. So he said it is not that there are different colors, there are simply different glasses. And you can even talk about it in terms of my glasses. We perceive the unified, undifferentiated divinity in different ways, different facets of a diamond, right? So that's what he said. But you're correct. This issue of multiplicity was a major issue. And in fact, to take this to a later stage, we all of us know that the Vilna, we talked about this a few weeks ago, I think, the Vilna Gaon and the early Hasidic movement had major disagreements, and the Vilna Gaon actually put the early Hasidic movement into Cherem. And there were many, many issues. Some of them were issues about Zman Kriya Shema, keeping Zman Kriya Shema. Some of them were issues about the Chashivas of Talmud Torah. But the major issue is an issue that is so arcane, so esoteric, that we wouldn't even necessarily think about it. But it was a major, major issue. And that is the notion of the basic idea that God is in everything and God is everywhere. Right? Chassidus teaches. And in a way, it's just the pasuk. Malay Kalaritz Kvodo Hashi, God is everywhere. So everything that exists is only because God is in it. So the Vilna Gaon maintains, that sounds like a very religious idea, the Vilna Gaon maintained it was a Bodhisattva pantheism, to say that God is in everything. So these issues are not, unless you're a Mekubal yourself, it's not so clear to differentiate that. But nevertheless, this is what Moshe Benivero says, that it's a matter of how we perceive reality as opposed to what is the reality. The reality is something that's not perceptible, but it's a unitary reality. Okay, yeah.
Could it be possible then that you would have like a group of Catholics who would be kind of working under that assumption and then actually be within the Noahide laws?
Well, absolutely. You know, absolutely. You know, as I say, when we describe a religion as equaling X, that is only if the believers in the religion believe X. If they believe something else, then it's entirely possible. In fact, first of all, Rabbeinu Tam himself said that even Catholicism in the conventional way it's understood was not idolatry under the Noahide laws. That was Rabbeinu Tam's opinion. The Rambam maintained that it was. In a censored passage of the Rambam differentiated between Islam, which he said was a monotheistic religion, although it's a bloodthirsty terrorist religion, but nevertheless it is a monotheistic religion, versus Catholicism, which was an idolatrous religion. This is the Rambam. Rabbeinu Tam, who lived in Catholic France, said not. And in some ways, perhaps it's not really an argument in principle, it's really just an argument over what assumption of the Trinity were they working with. And you're correct, it's entirely possible to have a model that would make it parallel to some degree to the spheros.
So there's certain mitzvot that only men are commanded to do. And in general, men don't consider this a huge burden. They're usually quite excited to be able to do these mitzvot to feel closer to God. And then one of the answers given for the reason why women don't have to do this is because women are at a higher spiritual level. I know there are other answers, but this is always the one that's troubled me because I find it difficult on an intuitive level to understand this. But then recently, further on an intuitive level, I heard that Rashi's daughter used to put tefillin on. And the reason given for this at the time, to me anyway, was that they were on such, their family was on such a high spiritual level, you see where I'm going, were on such a high spiritual level that his daughters wore tefillin. So obviously, now it seems contradictory.
Yeah, it's contradictory, yeah. That is a very, very good point. But I think that, to get into the issue of, for so many years, women complain, not women, modern women, I don't mean traditional, women complained, oh, women are inferior, so we now have a counter-reaction. No, really, men are the inferior ones. So not men are going to complain, why are we so inferior? So in a sense, I think the more helpful way to look at it is not who is superior, who is inferior. Rather, everyone is equally beloved by Hashem, everyone is equally important, but people have different roles in life. And the way a woman serves Hashem is not supposed to be the same as the way a man serves Hashem. And we really believe separate can be equal. There can be equality with difference. And even what's called post-feminism actually understands that idea, that equality of men and women does not have to mean they do exactly the same thing. But tefillin, I think, has a unique issue. Let me give you a little introduction to that. Women don't wear tefillin because it is a positive commandment that has a time. You don't wear tefillin at night. And therefore, women are pachur. But here, the question I want to raise is the following. There are a lot of mitzvahs that women are pachur from, but they're still allowed to do. For example, women are pachur from hearing shofar and Rosh Hashanah, because it's Zman Gerava, and yet, voluntarily, they go ahead and do so. Women are pachur from sitting in a sukkah, but they can do so. Women are pachur from lulav, they can do so. And not only can they do so, but they get reward, because the Rambam says if a woman does a positive commandment that is time-bound, even if she's not commanded, she gets reward. And not only that, but here we get an interesting machlokas, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. According to Ashkenazim, women can even make the bracha. When a woman takes a lulav, she can even make a bracha, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav b'tzivanu al netilas lulav. Sephardim, based on the Rambam, say not, because how could she say she was commanded? But the point is this. Whether she makes a bracha or not, for every other mitzvah saseh that's time-bound, she's allowed to do, and she gets reward. Tefillin, the Ramah says, not only is she exempt, but she's not even allowed to put on tefillin. Now, I'll get to Rashi's daughters in a second. So, before we get to your philosophical question, one could ask a simple question. Why don't I treat tefillin the same way I treat a lulav or a sukkah? Don't have to do it. If you want to do it, do it. Why do I all of a sudden say, cannot do this one? So, the explanation that the Aruch HaShulchan gives is the following. Tefillin is very holy. And tefillin, you're supposed to concentrate when you wear your tefillin and not talk and not joke around, not engage in casual conversation. If you don't have full control of your bodily function, one is not supposed to, even if one just has, you know, flatulence, whatever it is, one does not wear tefillin, etc. And that is why, for men, even though the mitzvah of tefillin was to wear it the whole day, we stopped doing it. We only limit for the zaman that you have to. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, the reason why women don't wear tefillin, or forbidden to wear tefillin, is because by tefillin, you always go down to the minimum. Because of its great kedusha, we do as little as we need to do. So for men, the minimum is kriya shema and shmoneh esrei, no davening. For women, the minimum is zero. So it's not a question of men and women being superior or inferior. Rather, given the reality that men are chayav and women are not,
say, what is chayav?
Obligated. We simply say everybody only does the minimum that they need to do, and nobody does more than the minimum because we're not worthy of that kedusha. Again, it's not that women are less worthy than men. It's rather, let's assume men and women are equally unworthy. But if men have a chiyuv, we got to do something. Women, an obligation. If women don't have a chiyuv, don't have an obligation, so they do less. Now, so when we come up with Rashi's daughters, we simply say, just as there are men, even today, who actually wear tefillin the whole day. Tzaddikim and the Vilna Gaon, of course, in previous generations, wore tefillin all day because they were capable of the requisite concentration and kavana. So too, there might theoretically be women who would be capable of the same level. And when they reach that level, they will be permitted, though not obligated, to wear tefillin. Okay? So the issue is, so the point I'm making is the following. The exemption of women from tefillin is not because they are inferior to men. It might very well still be that they are spiritually superior, and therefore they were not given a commandment. But when we come to then prohibiting them to wear it, it would simply be because men and women both have problems in sustained concentration. So you knock them down to the minimum level. It's a little complicated in that way. Now, let me point out that the simplest explanation for why women are exempt, well, the simplest explanation is, the Torah just says so, we don't know. No, but the simplest rational explanation is given by the Avudraham, who simply says that since women are on call to take care of their children and their home, so any mitzvah that has to be done within a certain time, you can't really say, do it now, because they might be busy with taking care of their children at that moment. So if it's a mitzvah that says, do it anytime you want, that's one thing, but you can't, you know, give them a mitzvah that has a time. Okay, so that's why tefillin. So tefillin, in a sense, is a complicated mitzvah because it is a unique category in which not only are women exempt, but they're, unless they're at a high level, they are actually prohibited. Just as a man, if you were to ask me, let's say you felt inspired, you wanted to wear tefillin all day. Well, and you can point to all sorts of things. That is the original halacha. But I think, you know, we would discourage you from doing that because we're not on that madriga. On the other hand, let me tell you that, you know, it's interesting that some people are bringing it back. And I don't know if you know the Zilberman educational system. This is a wonderful, wonderful elementary school system here in Eretz Yisrael, which wants to go back to the minhagim of the Vilna Gaon, and they follow Pirkei Avos ultimately. For 5 years, from 5 to 10, they only learn Chumash and Tanakh, all of Tanakh. They know it by heart, like they know all of Tanakh by heart with the Trump even. So you wouldn't have a problem Monday and Thursday to have a Balkari. Any Zilberman boy could learn any parsha he wants. And then from 10 to 15, they only do Mishnayos, Mishnah. And they don't start Gemara until 15 years old. But by the time they do Gemara, they have learned Chumash and Mishnah, you know, tremendous. It's really a tremendous chinuch system, and the kids love it, and they're very motivated. But one of the things they also do, at least some of the kids, is they start having the kids' words filled in the entire school day. It's like, it was very unusual. You see them Erev Shabbos, they're already dressed for Shabbos, and they're still wearing their tefillin till right before Shabbos, when they take it off. But again, that's a rare thing, and by and large, the poskim don't encourage that, because without the right kavana, it's a sin to wear the tefillin. Okay, so that's how you reconcile the contradiction. But you are correct. I don't know if there's a direct source for it, but many people do say that Rashi's daughters did wear tefillin. And it's also said Rashi had no sons, but it is also said that Rashi's daughters, he learned Gemara with them, and they actually taught Gemara from behind the curtain. They would actually give Gemara classes, and some even say that, you know, there's a commentary on Rashi's commentary on Maseches Nozir. Maseches Nozir may have been written by his daughters. Now, I hope, people tend not to learn the commentary on Rashi and Nozir. Now, I hope that's not the reason. they tend to learn, because Rashi and Nozir is an extraordinarily difficult commentary. People learn the Tosfos instead of the Rashi. But some say the commentary of Rashi and Nozir was from his daughters.
Why did Moshe and Aaron ask Paro to send the Jews out for 3 days when really they wanted to leave for battle?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, right? I hope everybody looked at this in the Chumash. And that is, the Jewish people seem to have gained their freedom by false pretenses. Moshe asks three times, give us 3 days, and we will go into the desert, and we will sacrifice to God. And Paro said no. Number one, there are really two. All right, there are a few questions here. What if Paro would have said yes? So what was supposed to happen? Would they go for 3 days and come back? Or was this just a trick? And if it was a trick, what type of deception is going on? So in the Mefarshim, there are two Mahalchim. Some Mahalchim actually say that after Makas Bechoros, it was understood they were going for good. That wasn't the issue. But initially, Moshe was negotiating for a vacation. And had there been a vacation, the Jews would have come back. And the theory is the following. The Jewish people should have been in Mitzrayim 400 years. But what was our problem? Our problem is that they were hitting the 49th level of impurity. Had they stayed any longer, they would have assimilated. They would have been not worthy of redemption. But in theory, optimally, we needed the 400 years. In fact, I think I mentioned that the Shearim, that because we didn't stay the extra 190 years, we had this cancer that needs thousands of years of gullus to purify. So the 3-day break would have restored us spiritually. It's like going to yeshiva for 3 days, meaning we're on the 49th level of tumah. So Hashem doesn't really want to take us totally out, because that destroys the process of the 400 years. So the 3 days would have been enough. But since Paro didn't agree, so Hashem took us out legami. That's one interpretation. Which means, in other words, that's why you'll notice that although Moshe brings up the 3 days, he doesn't bring it up with Makas Bechoros. Makas Bechoros, he tells Paro that after this we're going. Other Mefarshim say differently. Other Mefarshim say that this was intentional deception. And that is why Paro runs after us, right? We're going to see in this week's Parsha that when the Jewish people are at the Red Sea, Paro says, what's going on? We sent the Jews away. Well, what do you mean? You sent the Jews away. What are you running after the Jews? Are you changing your mind? That's how I think most people learn. But some Mefarshim learn, no. Paro was actually surprised in some ways. He says, I thought they were gone for 3 days. It's 3 days already. Nobody's back. So he runs after them. So, according to this, it's a little difficult morally, but according to this, Paro and Mitzrayim were tricked so that Hashem could lure them to the Yamsuf, where they would meet their ultimate destruction. Because had Paro known that they were going for good, he would not have pursued them to the Red Sea, and he would not have been drowned, or Mitzrayim would not have been drowned. So this was the mechanism by which Hashem lured the Mitzrayim out. They also say, although again, there's some difficulties here, they also say that this was the mechanism by which the Jewish people were able to get the gold and silver vessels to which they were entitled. And they simply told the Egyptians, hey, give us the gold and silver, we're leaving. The Egyptians might have said no. But if they let us borrow it for our three-day vacation, the Egyptians would say yes. So essentially we have two different approaches in the Mefarshim. Was this something that was initially requested with the Kavana that we could therefore go back and finish our 400 years, which would have been the best thing, but after Makas Bechoros it was understood that this was for good? Or was this a continual misrepresentation in order to lure Mitzrayim to their death at the Yamsuf to make the ultimate Kiddush Hashem? And there are Mefarshim that simply say that this is a war against Egypt. This was a war against Mitzrayim. In fact, somebody wrote a very satirical article. Had there been a United Nations at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, they would have written up the 10 plagues about, you know, war atrocities and chemical warfare and changing water to blood. You know, we've never heard such a thing. And in war, this is a melchama. In war, we are permitted to do what we can to destroy this enemy that tries to destroy us. And this three-day story was a way of getting them to the upside. Yeah.
I heard that regarding Kiddush HaKodesh, that Re'ia was more of a formality, and that the Sanhedrin had knew that through the Soda Ebor were able to formulate the months. And wondering what exactly that means.
Yeah, this is a huge machlekes of Sadra Gaon and the Rambam. The Rambam views it this way. The Rambam views that Lehepach, the Iker Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctification of the new moon, was two witnesses testifying they saw the new moon, and the Sanhedrin would be Makadesh Rosh Chodesh based on the testimony of the new moon. That is the Iker Mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, that we sanctify Rosh Chodesh, and therefore the holiday, because all the holidays are called on Rosh Chodesh, by testimonial witnesses. But, the Rambam says, the Sanhedrin mathematically also computed Rosh Chodesh as a check to determine whether the witnesses are lying or telling the truth. So it is not the cheshbon that is the ikar, but the cheshbon, the calculation. The cheshbon was a necessary check on the veracity of witnesses. That if witnesses said things that were clearly incorrect based on the mathematical calculation, the Sanhedrin was able to assume that the witnesses were fraudulent and would not accept their testimony. There are, Rav Sadia Gaon, other Gaonim, took an opposite position, and they said that you never just like today you don't need witnesses. You didn't even need witnesses then. It was just a ceremony. It was like an extra mitzvah that was done to have witnesses, but it was not an essential part of Kiddush HaChodesh. And according to Rav Sadia Gaon, the Iker was cheshbon, and not Re'ia. Again, the reason why there's a problem, let me explain why there's a problem. The problem is this. The problem is, if you learn like the Rambam, that the Iker thing that makes Rosh Chodesh Rosh Chodesh are witnesses who saw the new moon and the Sanhedrin being Mekadesh, the new moon, then how could we have Rosh Chodesh today? Today we don't have a Sanhedrin. We don't have witnesses who testify. And if we don't have Rosh Chodesh today, that means we don't have holidays today. How could there be a Pesach? How could there be a Rosh Hashanah? How could there be a Yom Kippur? So Rav Sadia Gaon's answer was that even Bizman HaMikdash, you really didn't need the witnesses. It was an astronomical, mathematical calculation. The Rambam's understanding would be that the Torah created a two-tiered system, that when there is a Beis HaMikdash and a Sanhedrin, you're Makadesh according to witnesses. When there's no Sanhedrin, the Kiddush HaChodesh takes place by Cheshbon, right? Rav Sadia Gaon learned that there's a single system. The Rambam learns there was a double system in play. That's the halacha of Moshe Mishina.
Would it have anything to do with the fact, like nowadays our look is that certain chagim and whatnot can't fall out on certain days? Would that explain it at all? Like when the Sanhedrin was in place, that they formulated similar.
Okay, so that's a big machlokas. Again, what you call the Soto Eber. Soto Eber is the phrase. The secrets regarding the calculations of the Jewish calendar. And we know, for example, there are many, many features of the Jewish calendar. It's a very brilliant and intricate type of system. For example, why do we have leap years? 7 out of 19 years has an extra month. because a lunar year, 12 lunar revolutions, is only 354. A solar revolution, or the Earth revolving around the sun, is 365. These are approximations. There's an 11-day discrepancy, and therefore what's going to happen is that every lunar day is going to move 11 days earlier. Right? So if one year Pesach falls out April 15, the next year is going to be April 4. The next year is going to be March, 24, 25. And what's going to eventually happen is that Pesach will be in the winter, but the Torah says Pesach has to be in the spring. So every number of years, 7 out of 19, we have an extra month that pushes Pesach into the spring. We have rules that Rosh Hashanah cannot be on certain days. Lo Adu Rosh, that's Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. Pesach cannot be on certain days. So the question that you're asking is that a result of our predetermined calendar? But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if witnesses came Sunday and said, we saw the new moon, we would make that day Rosh Hashanah. So that's a big machlokes. Many Rishayim, we don't have definitive proof, many Rishayim say that all of the features of the Jewish calendar are only after we no longer sanctified according to witnesses. But when we sanctified according to witnesses, as long as astronomically they were not mistaken as to the new moon, we would accept their testimony. And in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and even afterwards, until the Sanhedrin stopped sanctifying the Kodesh, we would indeed observe Rosh Hashanah even on the wrong days, so to speak. Others say that what are called the dechios are the pushing off of the day, that occurred even bisman HaBeis HaMikdash. So there is a big machlokes about that. And the Gemara, there are contradictions in a number of Gemaras. Yeah.
Can Tinoch Shenishba be used to alleviate the wrongdoing of someone who's transgressed a Noahide law?
Yeah, very excellent question indeed. Tinoch Shenishba is a paradigm case of the baby that was kidnapped and raised in an idolatrous environment. So we say because the person was never really exposed, usually to Judaism or to Torah, so they are not fully responsible for whatever sins they commit. And that's been, although in the Gemara, Tinoch Shenishba means a kidnapped child, but today many poskim will apply it to virtually many, many Jews who are raised in secular environments or non-Orthodox environments. And some people, not everybody, will say, for example, that even though if a non-Shomer Shabbos person touches wine, according to the law of the Gemara, that wine would be treif. But today, a typical non-Orthodox person is called a Tinoch Shenishba and the like. So the question, not everybody agrees with that, but many will apply Tinoch Shenishba to the modern Reformed conservative Jew, even if they knew Orthodox people, but they weren't raised to think that that meant anything important. So the question becomes, okay, so Tinoch Shenishba might be seen as a mitigating circumstance. If I don't put on tefillin, if I don't know about shatness, if I don't know that you're not supposed to do work on Shabbos, I could say Tinoch Shenishba, I was just raised in a society that didn't think that that was important or I never knew about it. But what about a non-Jew or even a Jew who doesn't even keep a basic Noahide law, like not killing, not stealing. But he says he was raised, whatever, he was raised in some society that thinks it's okay to kill if you want somebody's coat, or whatever it is. Is there a defense of Tinoch Shenishba on the basic principles of the Noahide law? The Gemara says there is not. And that's called, what you're talking about is an Omer Mutter, a person who simply thinks a certain law is permitted under the Noahide law. Apparently, the assumption is that these laws are so fundamental to a basic sense of human conscience that God considers every human being as worthy of knowing and understanding the basic content of those laws. So as a result, there generally speaking is no concept of a Tinoch Shenishba on the Noahide laws itself. Just to give you another chumrah of the Noahide laws, you know, a violation of the Noahide laws carries the death penalty. Either way, I mean, today that's not done, but if there would be a Jewish court enforcing the Sheva Mitzvahs of Noah, or even a non-Jewish court enforcing the Sheva Mitzvahs of Noah, the penalty is a death penalty. Of course, that raises an interesting question, a very disturbing question. You know, if you take people like the Taliban, right? So the Taliban will go around killing, a kid steals an apple from a store, you know, they'll kill the child. And we say, oh, that's barbaric, you know, you're killing a child. You're cutting off his hand, you're killing a child because he stole an apple. But then we have to ask ourselves, wait a second, you're stealing an apple is one of the seven commandments of Noah, and don't we say the punishment is death penalty? If you had a halachic Noahide society, all right, so we wouldn't kill the Jews who steal apples. That's fine, okay? Good, so we're not going to kill, you know, we're not going to kill us, but we're going to kill them because they stole an apple? Isn't that like the Taliban at that point? So I'll tell you a very, very interesting chiddush that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, and I wish I could find a makor for this in Rishonim. I have not found anything in Rishonim that addresses it. But this was his chiddush, and he said it was so pashutim. He said this was pashutim. To me, it's not pashut, but it's very, very logical. He said the following. He said that when the halacha says that the punishment for the Noahide violations is the death penalty, that doesn't mean that's a mandatory death penalty. It means Hashem left it to the Noahide societies to determine whatever punishment they considered appropriate, even if that would mean putting people to death. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically says to them, I'm giving you the laws and you determine the punishment. So he says, they have reshus to impose a death penalty. But it's not that Hashem wants them to do that. And they could impose imprisonment, they could impose fines. In other words, they are simply given, it's like Hashem is giving them, unlike halacha, where for the Jewish people we are told what punishments we have to give, Noahide courts are given unlimited discretion. But that, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, if they're civilized people, they're not going to kill, you know, every kid who steals an apple and the like. As Hashem just said, I'm leaving the punishment up to you. That's a very, very interesting chiddush, and that's not the way most people understand the Gemaras that say the Noahide violations are death penalties. But this was what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said. And at least we understand Hashem is not mandating a death penalty for those sins.
Good question. Do we find any references to the Kabbalah as like a body of works in the Gemara? And if not, why not? / how do we know it existed then if we don't find any references?
Certainly there are clearly passages in the Gemara that make reference to mystical traditions that were handed down from generation to generation to be taught in very, very small groups. This is what is referred to as Maaseh Bereishis, the secrets of Hashem creating the world, and Maaseh Merkava, the secrets of the divine chariot, the Kisei HaKavod. And the second parak of Chagiga has several blocks which talk about these mystical doctrines and these mystical experiences, and the famous passage of the four great rabbis who entered the Pardes, that's the sacred garden, and one of them became a heretic, Elisha ben Abuya, and one of them died, and one became crazy, and only Rabbi Akiva entered in peace and left in peace. So there absolutely is a reference to a notion. Now, it does not use the word Kabbalah, if that's what you mean.
Right.
It doesn't use the word Kabbalah, but that's just a matter of a name. I mean, Kabbalah just means a received tradition, right? A received tradition. In fact, when the Gemara uses the word Divrei Kabbalah, which it uses, it never means mystical doctrine. It means the words of the prophets are called Divrei Kabbalah. So nomenclature is just nomenclature, but the idea that there was a mystical tradition known to Yechidei Segula, special individuals, that is absolutely clear in the Gemara. Now, the only Kabbalistic work that is explicitly referred to in the Gemara is Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is a book, you can even get an English translation of Sefer Yetzirah, you wouldn't understand it so much, that is the different combinations of the alephbeis that Hashem used to create the world. And the Gemara mentions that there were certain Tanam and Amoraim that every Friday they would create a cow or a calf through Sefer Yetzirah that they would shecht and eat on Shabbos. There was no reference to the other Svarim. Why that's so? Well, I don't know. It depends. Obviously, Some were not written yet, right? But on the other hand, the Zohar, that gets us into a big issue of when the Zohar was written. As you know, that is a huge, huge machlokes. Most probably today, attribute the Zohar to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived before the Mishnah. On the other hand, Yaakov Emden pushed the Zohar off so late to the 1200s, Rav Moshe de Leon. So one of Yaakov Emden's points is, why does the Gemara make no reference to the Zohar? And then that's exactly his point. But whether or not a specific books were written down is absolutely clear. There was a core of knowledge. I mean, this is just the second chapter of Chagiga. You can clearly see that there is a reference to this knowledge. And at the same time, there are many, many warnings not to get too involved in it. And that could be why we don't mention specific books. Okay, anything else today? Okay, y'all have a good